This week I was preparing a teaching for the study and practice group called Way of the Bodhisattva. So, of course, compassion has been on my mind. And I was looking through an old book I had, and a piece of paper fell out. It was folded into a little square, and I opened it. And it was three sentences written by my teacher, Lama Michael, maybe a long time ago. His handwriting was a little cryptic, so it always takes me some time to kind of decode it. But what it said was, we all say that we want to develop compassion, yet there's something frightening about the process. What are we actually afraid of? Great question. I think anybody who wants to be compassionate, and by compassionate I mean who wishes that others didn't suffer and that we could relieve their suffering or take their suffering, anybody who wants that has to also know on some level, somewhere in the back of their mind, that this will also be trouble of some kind, right? To develop that capacity will be uncomfortable, difficult, challenging. Everyone talks about compassion. I did a Google search the other day. How many books are there on compassion? And it turns out there are 40,000 books on the topic. So if Google's right, and who knows, but if Google's right, that means a lot of people are interested in the topic and writing about it, thinking about it. But when we say compassion in the Buddhist context, we mean a very specific kind of compassion. And then you have to ask the question, do we really know what we're talking about? And do we know why it's important to develop compassion? And of course, if we think it is important, do we know how to cultivate the ability to be compassionate? In the 7th century, there was an Indian teacher named Chandrakirti, and he wrote a text called the Madhyamaka Vatara. And in that text, right at the beginning, he suggests that compassion is not only a nice way to be, a nice quality to have. Compassion is actually the foundation of awakening. Compassion compared with wisdom, the practice of those two things, the cultivation of those two things. And by wisdom, I mean the understanding and the direct experience of truth. This is the method for liberation. He wrote in that book, that text, Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. The mind of compassion, non-duality, and enlightenment are the causes of bodhisattvas. Kindness is considered to be the seed of the abundant harvest, which is Buddhahood, like water that causes it to grow over a long time and ripen in a state of joy. So let me read that one more time. It's a little dense. Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. The mind of compassion, non-duality, and enlightenment are the causes of bodhisattvas. Kindness is considered to be the seed of the abundant harvest, which is Buddhahood, like water that causes it to grow over a long period of time and ripen in a state of joy. And that's compassion. Lama Michael's writing was inviting the exploration, you know, questions about a very real issue in the development of compassion, which is that the process of cultivating compassion is not warm and fuzzy. It is not comfortable. It is not always joyful. In fact, anybody who wants to cultivate compassion, who even turns in that direction, will know, even if it's not on a conscious level, that somehow this might be a risky process or an uncomfortable process. I know that. You know that. This compassion that Chandrakirti references is very specific in its meaning. And maybe it's not the way that we use the word exactly now. So nowadays, when we talk about compassion, we're often talking about a sense of pity or kindness or caring for a few folks with whom we identify and to whom we relate, someone we love, our favorite pet, our children. This Mahayana compassion that Chandrakirti was referencing is a universal compassion, and it's extended towards all sentient beings, all conscious beings, without a single exception. Think about that for a minute. What would be required to have that kind of compassion? The compassion that doesn't pick and choose between recipients. What would you have to accept, and what would you have to relinquish to have that kind of compassion? Those are two important contemplations, I think. For most of us, we arrived at compassion, you know, some degree of it, by trying to be kind or helpful or empathetic to the people that we get along with, or maybe in the case of work, you know, the people we want to get along with. And that is an important step. That's critical. And most people make some effort at that. Buddhist compassion even kind of backs up from that little bit in the formal training for compassion. And we start maybe with compassion for ourselves. In fact, we start not by having compassion for ourselves, but I usually start in my own practice and with students. I would say, remember a time when someone, even if it was you, extended compassion to yourself. How did it feel? And we might take a minute in that exploration to rest down into the feeling of the memory, to notice the body sensations, to notice if the heart is open or closed, as we remember when someone maybe was compassionate to us and what it felt like to be receiving of compassion. It's hard to cultivate a quality that you haven't experienced. And it's hard to cultivate a quality that you only know in a hazy, fuzzy way. So that's where I usually start, and start with others. And once you remember that and you familiarize yourself with it in your body and in your memory and in your mind, and then you can begin to offer compassion to yourself. And you might do that, for example, with a practice like taking and sending, which is called Tonglen. And then once you know what it's like to extend it to yourself, and as you do it, you know, you can see where your self-compassion is stuck and where it's easy and where it's manipulative or false in some way, suspect in some way. You're the only person who can see that, those things that arise when you are extending compassion to yourself. So after you do that, then the classic sequence is having done that and having noticed some things and therefore being aware of some things about your relationship to compassion for yourself, then you would call to mind someone with whom you have a very easy relationship. Maybe somebody that loves you and someone that you love. And when you think of them suffering and you think of offering them compassion or them offering you compassion, you probably have some history with that, right? And so you can kind of sift through those experiences and again, notice the body, the mind, the heart. What does it feel like when compassion flows easily, when it's working, when it's not blocked? And you do that for a while, and then you might move along in that contemplative exercise to a person we might call a neutral person. You know, somebody that you don't really think of as a friend, maybe not even an acquaintance, someone you wouldn't say is in your circle of relationships. You know, this could be somebody at the grocery store or someone you pass on the street. And we use an exercise, a contemplative practice like Tonglen, to send them compassion. And we do it for a while on the in-breath and the out-breath. In-breath and the out-breath. And we notice, is it the same as extending compassion to someone we love? Is it easier, harder? Are we distracted more? Do we just lose the connection or lose the motivation because this is a so-called stranger? And we just do that. And from that stage of the practice, we learn something about our connections with people. And the next kind of classic stage of that part of compassion practice would be to offer compassion to someone with whom you have a difficult relationship. And, you know, difficult is a spectrum, right? So it could be somebody that irritates you mildly. The person at the desk next to yours at work who chews their gum with their mouth open, maybe. Or it could be someone who caused you great harm at some point in your life. I probably wouldn't recommend starting with that, but certainly sooner or later one will work with those very challenging relationships. And again, as we offer them compassion in a contemplative practice, we look and see, is it easy? Is it hard? What comes up? Do we feel nauseous? Where is that nausea? How big is it? What's that energy feel like? And we're not thinking about that, really. We are noticing those experiences. And there are experiences in the body, and then, of course, there are also experiences in the mind, memories and images. And maybe there are feelings. It's kind of hard to tell, is this body, is this mind? But maybe we feel contraction and kind of shutting down or a reservation. Or sometimes, you know, people will describe a definitive edge, like I can't go beyond that with this person. And then the sequence ends, and it always ends, and there's many reasons for this, but it ends with the extending of compassion to all sentient beings without limit. Without picking, without choosing, without taking sides. And at that practice, we're going to see something about our own relationship to compassion, but also to big experiences, like everything or all beings or no sides. And so that stage of the practice causes us to consider truth in its wholeness without dividing. And maybe it feels impossible to you at that stage, or maybe it feels easy, or maybe you just can't keep your mind on it, or maybe it seems humorous to you. There's no right experience to have at that stage of the practice. But whatever you see and whatever you notice teaches you something. So that practice of compassion, whether it's just saying hello to someone that you don't like, or using contemplative exercises like Tonglen, it will always, at some stage, in some way, produce a little discomfort. Maybe it produces, like I said, that kind of firm sense of boundary. Like, I could be tolerant, but I can't be accepting, or I can't be generous, or I can't wish they didn't have their suffering because it seems like it's their fault, that kind of thing. In fact, the practice of compassion is so prone to causing discomfort or fear or both that we usually back up and we begin with another quality, something other than compassion, which is a little easier, which is loving kindness. And we can do that same contemplative exercise sequence that I talked about, where you start with yourself and you remember when someone extended loving kindness to you, or when you extended it to someone else in a situation that was easy. And you remind yourself, oh yeah, that's what it was like, that's what it felt like. And it's a felt experience in the body, in the gut, in the heart. And then you move on to loving kindness for yourself, for someone neutral, someone that you have a difficult experience with, in all beings. And if I skipped over the someone that you love, that's in there too. And this, the process of that is about seeing the same kinds of things that I talked about with the extending of compassion. But part of the reason that the compassion that's talked about in the Mahayana literature and teachings is uncomfortable is that it's expressed in a very extreme way. And this is the end game in Buddhist practice. It is extreme because it's all reaching and it's all of the time without a single exception. But you can't start there, of course. You have to start exactly where you are. And from there, you inch your way along. And you're always looking to move out towards the edge, where it's a little difficult, where it's a little ragged. Now, sometimes, I said inch by inch, you know, but sometimes you get pole vaulted because of an experience. So maybe you have a breakup in a relationship, or you get fired at work or something like that, and you're trying to extend compassion to people in the situation. And sometimes, you know, it actually works, and it can suddenly work for some unexplainable reason in a kind of leap forward sort of way. And you can make a lot of progress in a matter of moments. This is one of the ways that difficult situations can sometimes be blessings for people who are practicing. One of the supports when you're beginning to work with compassion, when you're beginning to kind of face the horizon of that aspiration of all-encompassing compassion, is that you start to contemplate and gradually to understand that no human being is inherently bad. Not to say that they don't do awful things, not to say that they don't have confusion, not to say that they don't harm other people and themselves in the process, but that you understand that they do those things because they are wounded and hurting. And that they are wounded and hurting because of experiences they've had, just like you and just like every other sentient being. And I don't mean this by way of excuse. It's just a kind of the architecture of hurt and the architecture of harm. So if they'd had a different experience, they'd be different. It's easier for people who have had the opportunity to be safe, people in a state of well-being, it's easier for them to be lovable and kind. So what would that be like to have this unbounded compassion that was extended equally to all beings, including oneself, by the way? One of the classic teaching metaphors for that is that that compassion would be fueled completely by a very thorough understanding that suffering beings cause harm. Suffering beings cause harm. And they would say that the compulsion, recognizing that, the compulsion to feel a wish that their own woundedness be relieved is as strong as the experience of a mother or a father standing on a riverside, a person who doesn't know how to swim, watching their only child drown. That's a pretty uncomfortable image, isn't it? You'd want to save them with all your heart. You might jump in whether or not you knew how to swim. You might call for help whether or not you felt safe to do that. You'd look around for things that you could reach out into the water that they could take hold of. Whatever you did, you might be able to put aside your own fear so that you could do what needed to be done. Mahayana compassion at its fullness of expression is like that. Only instead of it being for your own child, it's for everyone. For the every child in everyone. Because you have seen that everyone is that precious. And therefore you love them as you would love your own offspring. That's universal compassion. That's unbounded compassion. And even the experience of that compassion and fruition, I think, must have sorrow and pain and restlessness woven in, because this compassion does not choose. It doesn't pick and choose its object, and it doesn't choose at some point whether or not, you know, do I want to extend compassion? It isn't like that. I was talking to my teacher about this once, and he said, if Jens, that's my firstborn, was a small toddler and he ran out into the street and a car was coming and you thought that Jens was in danger, would you have to decide whether or not to rescue? And of course I thought I would not. It would just be what had to be done. That's compassion in its stability and in its strength. That's not comfortable. This kind of compassion is also a kind of love that doesn't take sides, that can't take sides. The bodhisattva is caught, suspended between suspended in the energy of discomfort. So that bodhisattva who's suspended in the energy of all of the things that could be done, does that mean you do nothing? Is that what compassion means? You sit by and do nothing? Absolutely not. If I had two big dogs that I love very much and they got into a fight at their feeding bowl, which big dogs sometimes do, I wouldn't just let them destroy each other, right? Out of love, we are compelled to do what can be done. But if we do what we do from a place of hatred, if we move right in and add our confusion to everybody else's confusion, to the wounding that causes the fighting in the first place, then our effort to help, as we do that, adds further to the conditions that make harmony and understanding impossible. So it isn't compassion, no matter how good our intentions were. It's confusion in action. So all of that, coming to learn that, requires a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of willingness to be uncomfortable. It's not like there's a manual that tells you what's the right thing to do in this situation and that situation. We have to figure it out in the moment. And so, of course, as beginners, we make mistakes. And that's a piece of the discomfort, too. And so we have to look at the questions that Lama Michael was asking. When it comes to the exercise of compassion, what are we actually afraid of? Think about it for a minute. Stop listening and think, what would be required to have that kind of compassion? What would you have to accept? And what would you have to relinquish to have that kind of compassion?